Welcome to the Redneck Dentist Podcast. I am Doc Mike, host of the podcast. A series of Forrest Gump-like events have brought me to where I am, a small-town country dentist. My experiences in country living, country freedom, country dentistry, and my reactions to pertinent current events will help you live a life of more freedom and less worry. Thank you for choosing the Redneck Dentist Podcast. So let's get to today's freedom-inspiring episode. Yeah, let's do this. This is Doc Mike, the Redneck Dentist. Thanks for joining me here live on Real Liberty Media. And if you are listening to the podcast sometime later, thank you for that. I appreciate it. I'm on live every Wednesday and Saturday night, 9 p.m. Eastern. So join us right here if you want to join the conversation. Come in the chat room on Real Liberty Media. You can talk to people there. You can ask me questions. You can make comments, whatever. Sometimes I'm reading it. Sometimes I'm not. That's not true. I'm always looking up there. I always like to check and see if anybody has any questions or statements or whatever. And sometimes I get distracted and lose my place, but that's okay. You know, I'm just having fun here. I really enjoy this. Honest to God, I'm telling you guys, hang on. I have so much fun doing this podcast. And I started doing some videos over on BitChute, Rumble, and Odyssey. It's a 5-minute video, so take some time, go check that out. It's Redneck Dentist on all three of those platforms also. And it has just been fun. And you know what else? For those of you who've been listening for a while, you know that I went to a complete Linux setup. No more Windows anywhere on my system. I am free from Windows, and I am absolutely loving it. It's fantastic. So let's get to the stuff of the show today. I wanted to mention, you know, we're getting a new golden retriever pup. She's about 4 weeks old now. We get to go meet her next Wednesday, so I'm really looking forward to that. You know, I just bought a Suzuki kind of dual sport motorcycle. I rode that to work. That is a riot. Very fun bike to ride, a lot different than the Harley because it's lighter, it's a different setup, it's just fun, so I'm really enjoying that. I have to cough, one sec. Wow, I really hate tapping the mic like that, but that's how I turn it on and off. Got to find a better way. Okay, so I've been sharing with you guys my own experience with dentistry and what dentistry is looking like these days. I have some news to share with you today that probably you're not going to hear this anywhere else. I can guarantee you're not going to hear this anywhere else. And it's not because it's unique to me or my practice or the company that I work for, but it is eye-opening, really. So the company I work for got a grant from somebody. I didn't really check into the details, even though I received the email. I didn't really look into it that deeply yet because everybody else is talking about it. And I was like, okay, they'll handle this and we'll figure it out. Here's what the grant is for. The grant is to encourage people to work more. Because the demand is so high and the supply is so low. And I've been saying for months now, since the COVID lockdown, how backed up the dental field is. And I'm sure it's the same in medical. And I don't know if medical systems are getting the same kind of grant, but here's the gist of it. So this money is to be made available for people to work more days than they normally work. So in my example, I work 4 days a week. So if I add another day or I decide to work on a Saturday or something like that, they're going to pay double time. Now, just imagine that. They're paying not only me, but the entire staff that would support me on that day. Everybody gets double time. So that should give you a pretty clear idea that dentistry is overwhelmed right now. Today we scheduled a patient, actually a patient came in for an emergency exam. He had split a tooth straight down the middle. And, you know, I looked at the x-ray and I asked my assistant, I go, hey, you want to take this out? Let's take this out today. She went and asked the patient, and sure enough, he said, yeah, that'd be fine with him, which is a good thing. Because my next available appointment is in October. It is May right now. My next available appointment is October. I don't know, you know, what it's like where you live. I'm thinking that, you know, in some areas, I would imagine some cities have so many dentists that maybe they're not as backlogged. But then you have to go to the city, which, you know, I'm not in favor of at all. I hate the city, especially Portland. Oh, my God. And I got to tell you guys this, too. Okay, so keep that in mind, man. That there's, like, I don't know if this is a government. Obviously, it's a government grant from some government, either the U.S. or Oregon or counties. I don't know. It's from somebody. Oh, and by the way, it's only for the months June, July, and August, so it's not like it's going to go on for a year or so, at least not initially. But just keep that in mind. That's pretty dang serious that, you know, they're going to pay staff twice their salary to work more. You know, not just time and a half for overtime or whatever they negotiated, but double time to come in and work a day that you don't normally work. That is incredible to me. And it should kind of set your alarm bells off. What I'd like to, you know, pass on here is if you have even the slightest inkling that you have a dental condition that needs attention, now is the time to go make that appointment. You know, get that thing addressed, because it may be a long time before you can get in and see somebody and actually get definitive treatment done. Like, yeah, you may be able to go in on an emergency basis. Like some of my patients, they could come in any day. They can walk in. That doesn't guarantee they're going to get anything done, because there's no room in my schedule to provide care for somebody that walks in. I mean, I'm going to see you between two or three other patients that are already scheduled for treatment in an hour, which means each of those patients is going to get like 20 minutes, and then, you know, the additional walk-in emergency is going to get like a couple minutes for me to diagnose and write a couple prescriptions and tell them, you know, I'll see you in October. That's not true. I have a little procedure in place where we get people taken care of in a week or two. But, you know, I say that so nonchalantly, but this is actually what happens. Is so those patients come in who walk in and they like this guy today. Let's just say I couldn't see him today. I didn't have the time to literally go take his tooth out today. Well, I have told my staff, I go, just put him in somewhere in the next 2 weeks. You know, we'll get to him. Just tell him they're just going to have to sit and wait until I get a chance to get to him. And because I can't imagine somebody going with like a tooth that needs a root canal or an extraction or some infection. Like if I were to tell somebody who came in with an infection, I'm going to write you an antibiotic prescription for 10 days or 7 days or 4 days, whatever the antibiotic is. And then I'll see you in October. What do you think the chances of that infection coming back before October are? They're pretty damn high. In fact, I'm thinking within 6 to 8 weeks that infection is going to return. And so then am I going to keep that patient on antibiotics for, months until I get them back. See, that's bad practice too, because you get bacteria that are resistant to, you know, that antibiotic. So it'll get worse and it'll be harder to control and all that stuff. So there's systems in place, you know, to get people treated. But the bottom line is there's no time to treat those people. We're just like, you know, plugging people in and then, of course, working my ass off, basically, trying to get everybody treated. So, you know, and you all know, I'm always talking about retirement or kicking back to a couple days a week. But good grief, man. Until, you know, some more practitioners get out here in the field. I don't know. I think I'll just kind of keep doing what I'm doing for a while anyway. Which reminds me, next week I'm going to start that, the dentistry for the kids who are going to be under general anesthesia, and then I'm doing root canals for them because another practice asked me to come in and do that. And, you know, those kids are in the same boat everybody else is in. There's nobody seeing those kids right now. The specialists aren't seeing those kids right now. They're not even taking kids who need root canals on permanent teeth. And that's really sad to me because they're going to, if they don't get treatment, they're going to lose those teeth. Maybe even if they get treatment, they're going to lose those teeth. And that's just not fair. I mean, they're kids. They, you know, maybe didn't have parents who were helping them with oral hygiene or whatever. And, you know, as they get older, maybe they'll understand they have to brush and floss and save their teeth. But if they're gone already by the time you're 16 or 14, I mean, that's the only chance you have at, you know, keeping those teeth for the rest of your life. So anyway, that starts next week. So I'll have Wednesdays off, which will be kind of cool because I do this 1 hour live show on Wednesdays. I'll be doing those kids on Mondays. So Monday of next week is going to be the first session, and I'm kind of excited about it. Interested to see that get going and those kids get treated, and you know, it's just kind of another indication I'm trying to pass on to you about how difficult things are going to be for a long time, as far as I can tell. I really can't even, I don't even see where the end is for this. Well, except when we're all broke and starving to death and dentistry's about the last thing on anybody's mind, which that could come up really soon, probably later, you know, later this year, we're going to see that. Drink time. And since I'm kind of talking about, you know, all the shortages headed our way, I was watching the primary results yesterday here in Oregon. And I got to tell you, like, I think I was pretty accurate. I've said a few times in the last month or so not to be surprised by how kind of, you know, the common narrative is there's going to be a huge sweeping landslide turnover of the House and the Senate, you know, and the Republicans are going to take over and then everything's going to be just fine. Well, I was not very impressed with the numbers that I saw coming in from the primary here in Oregon. I don't know what the numbers are all across the country, but just imagine this. And I know this is common. I know this happens all the time, every election. It's like 30% of people turn out to vote. In Oregon, that's what it was, about 30% of people. Now, the reason I'm kind of relating this is because Oregon is a flipping disaster area right now. Portland, Salem, Eugene, those are kind of the three big metros in Oregon. They are disgusting places to pass through, to visit, to live in. Horrific conditions in those three cities. The homeless population, because basically Oregon has decided, hey, if you're homeless, we're going to support you. We're going to give you money. We're going to give you services. We're going to allow you to camp in city parks and, you know, neighborhoods. You can just park your RV, broken down RV, wherever you want. And you can use the street as a, you know, toilet, basically, and leave your garbage out. And, you know, we don't care. You're welcome here in Oregon. Well, you know, and also I've talked about the businesses in Portland before. I was like, hey, if you're doing business in Portland, number one, you're a flipping idiot, because Portland is disgusting. People don't even, honest to God, 25 years ago, my wife and I, okay, 20 years ago, my wife and I would like to go to Portland and get on the MAX train and do our Christmas shopping when it was cold and it was wet and it was rainy and the spirit was in the streets and, you know, you could walk the streets and just step into some of these quaint little shops along, along the city streets, just nice little shops. Not the big name shops, I mean little shops, local people, you know, having their own little business with unique merchandise to sell. And it was a great time. And, and people were friendly and it was clean. It's not like that anymore. Now people don't even want to walk those streets because they're disgusting. And they're filled with homeless, like druggies on the street right there. And nobody is doing anything about it. As a matter of fact, the mayor of Portland and the governor of Oregon both are totally fine with the way things are. So you would expect that there would have been a huge turnout of voters, even in the primaries, to say, okay, we have had enough. We're going to change the way things are done in Oregon. I'd say a very lackluster performance at 30%. Of, turnout for voting. Hang on, cough time. Sorry about that. But anyway, maybe things will be different in the election in November. I seriously doubt it. I've been saying forever, there's a lot of psyops going on right now. There's a lot of kind of mental, gymnastics going on to make us all believe that in November everything's going to be different. I have a few comments about that. Everything wasn't that different before. Like, okay, Trump did some things, but still, you had the same idiots in power. You have the same faces in the House and the Senate that we have seen for decades, doing the same things that they have done for decades. If it wasn't for Trump kind of stepping outside the box a little bit, his presidency would have been the same as all the rest of them, because they're all pretty much the same. And I just don't believe that things are going to change that much. I just really don't. We're headed, for hell quickly. And nobody's going to change that path. And it kind of makes me even more kind of ambitious about sharing what I do to be as self-sufficient as I can be and passing that along to other people, just my own experiences, because nobody's coming to save you. I don't care what party you are. The narrative right now is that we all need to hate each other, and if we could just hate each other enough to kill each other more than 10 at a time, let's go full-on civil war and just kill half the population of the country. That's what they really want. And as long as we continue to fight each other and see each other as an enemy, they're perfectly happy. I mean, this administration, look at this administration. You know, they called this Buffalo shooter a right-wing white supremacist when the guy actually wrote himself that he was an anarchist and leaned left. So the mainstream media, I mean, they have to put a label on him, and the label has to be he's a right-wing wacko. The truth is, he's a wacko, period. Doesn't have to be right or left. I said in one of my Take Fives this week, the dude is 18 for crying out loud. I seriously doubt he could identify. I don't think he could name 10 things that a Democrat, progressive, liberal, or Republican believe in. I seriously don't think he could. Like most 18-year-olds today, most of them can't read and write. Apparently, this kid could write. But, I mean, to honestly identify with one political party or the other, I don't see it. Sorry. I don't care what label you put on him. And the labeling is purely to stimulate an emotional response from the people who still follow mainstream media. And that's another reason why I love doing this podcast and why I love to encourage others to do a podcast, because your ideas matter. People are getting away from mainstream media. They're looking for information that isn't biased. I was reading this story about Twitter. You know, Elon Musk is I actually have some comments I want to make about Twitter bringing a knife to a gunfight with Elon Musk. I mean, it's been so funny to watch Elon. Like, he's like a chess player. He's so many steps ahead of the morons at Twitter. But here's the problem. Here's the problem, really, with Twitter. It's not the platform itself. It's the people who are running the platform. And I know you're thinking, well, yeah, of course it is. They're the ones making the rules. Yeah. But even worse, this is what happens. So you set up a platform, and then you make all the rules that is like, we aren't gonna disagree with comments that, you know, right wing people make, that conservative people make, that people with common sense or education make about vaccines and viruses and whatever. We're not going to argue with them, and we're not going to allow debate. We're just going to completely eliminate those comments. So what has happened is you've kind of created, if you're Twitter, you've kind of created this environment where you think everybody just is happy, you know, everything's hunky-dory, and, you know, everything that you've turned off, you don't listen to anymore, and you don't know what's going on out in the world. And so you think when a guy comes up and says, hey, I'm going to buy 9% of Twitter, and you're like, yeah, no problem. You know, we know you're an investor. That's cool. And then he goes, hey, I'm just going to take over Twitter. And then you start panicking because, you know, you think that you're in a position to negotiate with a dude who's so far ahead of you because you no longer have a brain. You no longer are able to counter a decent argument because everything you've had to do has gone exactly your way with no pushback, because all you had to do was eliminate those comments, and now you're not prepared for, you know, coming to do battle with Elon Musk. You created an environment where now you're totally weak and you look completely stupid because one dude who now you guys have said and made a big deal of him being special needs, well, guess what? You're getting your ass kicked by a special needs dude because you've made yourself defenseless, basically. You're not able to participate in a competition. because you've eliminated all the competition from your little platform, and now you've got nothing. You don't even have a knife for this gunfight. You're coming in defenseless, and you look completely stupid. Now, kind of along those lines, when Elon Musk started asking about, you know, how many real accounts there were on Twitter, I had this kind of interesting thought. So they say up to 20% of the accounts on Twitter are fake accounts and bots. So that means if you've participated in Twitter, 1 in 5 replies to your account is from a bot or a fake account. Think about that a minute. 1 in 5, and especially if you're a conservative or if you're intelligent, if you actually question authority and you can actually go and find facts and say, hey, you know, so if this vaccine is so good, how come people keep getting the virus even though they're vaxxed? And you can actually put that, you know, whole argument together with some facts to back it up, and you place that on Twitter and you get hammered by 1,000 frickin' responses that what a complete idiot you are for spreading disinformation about the vax, you can bet that more than 1 in 5 of those comments are coming from a bot or a fake account. 100%. You can guarantee that you're being beat up by a frickin' AI, which is awesome. It's awesome. At least you know, not real people hammering you, of course, but it sure looks like it, though. That's the problem, is it looks like there's all these people who are in disagreement with that comment that, you know, the vax sucks. But it's not really that many people. You know, I'm sure there's real people on Twitter. That's where they like to hang out because nobody, there's no competition. They don't have to create a perfect argument. They don't even have to create an argument. They don't have to arm themselves with facts because they can just sit in this nice little room of twits and they all agree on the same thing and they all support each other's, you know, babbling. And they don't have to be prepared to do any kind of debate. That's one reason why they always go to emotions, is because they can't have and use facts to make their arguments. I was saying earlier this week in another of my Take Fives that I couldn't find a reason why. I couldn't find one single medical reason why a full-term, well, an infant that had been born needed to be killed to save the mother. There is not one single medical condition where the mother and the baby have made it to full term and they're both healthy after the birth of the baby. There is not one single reason why that infant should be killed. It's purely murder, and it's purely choice, which I think we haven't actually picked up on that part of this whole debate, Roe v. Wade, that when women say pro-choice, they literally mean pro-choice. It's not about medical conditions, you know, that have to, the abortion has to be performed to save the mother. They want the choice to kill infants even after they're born because it's inconvenient. It's inconvenient. That's not a medical diagnosis, by the way. That's a personal choice. It's a choice somebody makes to go ahead and kill that infant because it's basically worthless to me. That's what they're saying. I don't want that thing. so it's okay to kill it. And there's states that are gonna go all the way. I bet Oregon's gonna be like this. Colorado was already doing this. Full term post delivery infanticide. That's what they want. Pro choice. You see? It's my choice. It's not my body anymore, my choice. It's my choice. Oh, how'd I get off on that little tangent? I know I was talking about Twitter and Elon Musk and off I went. That's okay. That's why I love doing it. I can just basically say whatever. Nobody's, oh my God, I can't believe I forgot this. Mount St. Helens erupted 42 years ago today, and I love to remember May 18th, 1980, because I was here. I was actually really close to here, but I was actually much closer to the mountain when it erupted. I'm just going to tell you a little story about Mount St. Helens eruption, because it is May 18th today. 42 years ago, Mount St. Helens erupted, and it was awesome, like unbelievably awesome. So that was in 1980. I was what, 20? Oh, I was 80, 70, 60. Yeah, I was 23 years old. I was in the Coast Guard, but I was at home on leave for the weekend from Seattle. And I was in Newburgh, which is kind of close to Portland, but not that close. Not so close that you can smell Portland. Well, probably on some days you can. But anyway, and it was 8:30 in the morning. We were all having coffee. We spent the night with some of my wife's family. And we woke up and we were having some coffee, and it was a nice day. So we were out on the deck, and, you know, the mountain had been rumbling for months, and the talk was that it was going to erupt, and, you know, we don't know when, but it's, you know, it's pretty high likelihood that it's going to erupt. And we're all standing out on the deck, and, you know, we're just talking about stuff, you know, just life. I mean, I was 23, for crying out loud. My wife was pregnant at the time, so, you know, it was, she was, so we had that baby September. Oh, no, July. We had that baby in July. So my wife was pregnant, and, anyway, we're having coffee out on the deck, and we hear this kind of big explosion, right? It wasn't like deafening. It was far enough away that it was like, wow, that was a big explosion somewhere. It was a long ways away. And we were all like, yeah, probably Mount St. Helens erupted. And at that time, you know, the TV was on, the morning news, and sure enough, they broke in, Mount St. Helens has erupted. We're like, oh my God, Mount St. Helens erupted. I wonder if we could see it, you know, and we start looking, and then I'm telling my wife, I'm like, hey, I got to get back to, you know, I got to get back to base. And that mountain is pretty much between here and there, depending on which way the ash and the lava and who knows what else falls. We're going to have to make it back to the base. So we basically packed up the car and started to head north to Seattle. And we could see that gigantic cloud rising up out of the mountain. I mean, Mount St. Helens used to be a beautiful snow-peaked mountain here in the Pacific Northwest, and it just blew like the top third off, you know. So what we had been used to seeing for our entire lives here in Oregon was gone. The top was gone, and there was smoke and ash coming out. And I'll tell you something else that was really crazy about the Mount St. Helens eruption. I've seen it in other volcanic eruptions on film, but in the Mount St. Helens eruption, you know, it creates its own weather. Like that plume of smoke and lava and ash creates its own weather. Yeah, it's a gigantic you know, hot mass of whatever, so sure, it creates that. But I mean, within that freaking column of smoke, there is freaking lightning bolts going off, you know, left and right. And I can't remember if there was clouds that day. It seems to me mostly it was clear, because we didn't have any problem seeing that mountain for most of the trip north. And here's what happened. We were going to take Interstate 5 all the way north to Seattle. But as soon as we left, they closed Interstate 5. So I was like, okay, we're going to have to head to the coast because that plume is moving east. We can't go east. So we're going to have to go west to the coast and work our way up the coast, which was going to take forever to get back to Seattle. Well, luckily, right when we get to Longview, Washington, where there's a bridge that crosses the Columbia River, we were listening to the radio, the news, you know, and they were like, yeah, the I-5 is going to be opening, or, you know, they expect it to be opening soon. It looks like the ash plume is moving east, so it's okay. So we crossed that bridge in Longview and headed back to I-5, and we were one of the first cars on I-5 heading north and staring at that gigantic column. I mean, you talk about those moments in your life where you are kind of faced with something magnificent, something you almost can't put into words how big and powerful and crazy it is that you're experiencing it. I mean, we were trying to head north. Of course, I felt at that time a duty to get back to the Coast Guard station because, you know, we do search and rescue and we do whatever, and, you know, maybe we were going to be needed. And I couldn't be AWOL, which I would have been if I would have headed back Monday morning, which is what we planned to do, because who knows what would have happened if the roads would have been closed. And I'm sure there would be some understanding, but who knows? I just felt compelled to go back there. So the whole drive from Newburgh to Seattle, you could see this mountain and the ash and the cloud. It was magnificent. It was awe-inspiring to see this natural wonder at work in our lifetime, and so local, like so close to where we had spent our lives growing up and working. And I'm not kidding. It's hard to put into words what that looked like and what that felt like. And, you know, I mean, you're kind of wondering at times, like, is everybody going to survive? I mean, who, you know, what happens when a volcano erupts? I mean, here we live in the, you know, Ring of Fire in the Pacific Northwest, and I'm sure that's not going to be the last volcano that ever erupts, but it was pretty cool to see it happen in our lifetime. And, you know, it was awesome. It was really awesome. And I'm sure a lot of you have also have some stories about when Mount St. Helens erupted. I don't know. That ash went forever. I mean, some of it landed in Wyoming, Montana, Idaho. I mean, ash even fell west toward the coast, because on our subsequent trips back to Portland or Eugene, which we did on the weekends because her parents were in Eugene, we would just stop and pick up some ash along the road, like a 5-gallon bucket, because people were selling it like crazy and making jewelry and all kinds of stuff. And yeah, it was illegal, like you're not supposed to, which is so stupid. There's like a bajillion tons of volcanic ash right there alongside the road, but you're not supposed to stop and pick it up. It's one of the dumbest things ever. Typical, though, government stuff. Yeah, don't pick up that. Don't pick up that volcanic ash. We need that. We're going to fine you if you pick up that volcanic ash. there's something about it that we don't want you to take it from here. Well, that was the other thing, man. You couldn't run your wipers. No, you could run your wipers, but you couldn't run the water from your wipers because it would just literally scratch the crap out of your windshield. I'm sure a bajillion people had to get windshields replaced after that eruption. And I bet it happens often after volcanoes erupt that, you know, windshields have to be replaced. I gotta wet the whistle. Hang on. Oh, so good. Okay, moving on. I was wondering, like, most of the country, and I think most of the world, people can pump their own gas. Now, I know you're probably thinking to yourselves, what is this idiot talking about? Well, guess what? In Oregon and in New Jersey, you are not allowed to pump your own gas. It's against the law for you to pump your own gas. I know you're probably thinking, what kind of freaking world do we live in? And yeah, it's crazy. Because, okay, my F-250 diesel, I can pump diesel. Like, you're allowed to pump your own diesel, but gasoline? No, no, no. You cannot pump your own gasoline here in Oregon. And I was listening to a guy, I guess because Oregon is one of the states, the local news did a story on New Jersey, which is another state where you can't pump your own gas. Apparently, I haven't been there, I don't know, but it was a story on the news, so it must be true. And the guy, like one of the guys they were talking to, he was like, you know, I mean, because there were people, they were asking, hey, do you think it's a good idea if we eliminate this law that says you can't pump your own gas? And this guy was like, well, you know, I really would like to see the, you know, the guys be able to keep their jobs. And I'm thinking to myself, there's like millions of jobs available right now. And there's like 2.5 jobs available for every person not working right now. And before you try and convince me that those jobs aren't that pumping gas is probably better than the jobs that are available, I'm not buying it. You know, I think you could move up from pumping gas. Hey, and I love the people that pump gas. Not really. But, you know, there's other jobs available. It's not like, hey, you could move inside and sell stuff at the retail portion of the gas station, right? I can tell you in Oregon, it's the most frustrating thing knowing that in every other state, you can pump your own gas. But in Oregon, when you pull into a gas station, you got to wait for the nice man, woman, to come over and pump your gas. Which means you can't pull into a gas station, pull up to the pump, get out, put your card in, put the nozzle in, pump your gas, and get in your car and go. Nope. You got to sit there until the one or two attendants at the gas station because, you know, you don't want to pay too many people to pump gas. You know, you only want the minimum number of people there to pump gas. And even now, I guess they're having a hard time finding people to work in gas stations, which is kind of crazy. It's not really. Nobody wants to go back to work. I guess that's the bottom line. Nobody wants to go back to work. But the deal is, so you sit there in a gas station for 10, 15, 20 minutes because you got one person trying to go fill up 8 cars or 2 people. trying to fill however many cars, you know, and you got to take their card and put it in the pump and take the nozzle and put it in the tank. And then, you know, some people only want $15 or $20 or, you know, yeah, I'll take a fill up, you know. So you got to like meet everybody's need. Whereas if you could just pull into the gas station and pump your own gas, you're in and out in minutes. Like, cause there's people not sitting around waiting for so-and-so to check you out and give you your receipt or whatever. It's irritating as hell. I mean, I'm really used to it because I've been living here all my life, and it's pretty much been the law here in Oregon my entire life. What I think is funny is that one of the arguments for getting rid of that law would be that, you know, we don't want to see a guy lose his job. Well, come on, man. This administration has done such a... Don't you know that this administration has created more jobs than any administration in the history of the United States? Come on, man. Go get yourself a job. They're out there. Oh, speaking of Biden. So today, I'm hearing this story that... Biden's daughter has COVID, and then I heard the follow up was like, Biden's not at risk because they haven't been spending time together, and I'm like, that's funny. Why didn't you say Biden's not at risk because he's been triple vaxxed and triple boosted or quadruple boosted? Why didn't you say that? Because everybody knows that vax is crap. So, you know, the story is, you know, the President of the United States is not in any danger because he hasn't been around his daughter for 48 hours. Really? Come on, man. Now is the time you could have made the argument of how great your vaccine is. But of course you won't. Matter of fact, you won't even bring it up because everybody knows. I mean, every single week, more and more information comes out from studies done by institutions with people with brains to show just how horrible the vax is. It is useless, virtually useless. Like, I can't think of anything good about any of the mRNA vaccines. As a matter of fact, more information came out this week about how bad this frickin' vaccine is for you. In fact, I'm kind of surprised they keep giving it to Biden. Well, we all know he's not getting the vaccine. He's getting saline. They wouldn't dare use an experimental drug on a sitting president of the United States, even if they wanted to kill him, which I'm sure they don't. But they wouldn't dare use this experimental drug on a sitting president. You can guarantee none of those people got vaccines. And that is why the argument was that president is in no danger because he hasn't been in the company of his daughter for however many hours or days. That should tell you everything you need to know right there. But so many people won't even hear that. But I did. And I know many others have too, and that's awesome. We have a few minutes left. I wanted to talk about this one thing that's happening in the Pacific Northwest. And I've talked about it before, but it's come up again because, of course, now we're entering that time where everybody's going to start creating these freaking laws to be voted on. Although, I guess this is kind of that time of year when they stop that kind of stuff because they know that there's going to be some turnover in personnel, well, in some states anyway, it's not going to happen here in Oregon. I can just guarantee it's not going to happen in Oregon, unfortunately. But so in Washington, the next state north of us here in Oregon, there's been this battle going on about wolves and cattle. And I guess that's one of those battles that has been going on for years and years, probably, what, a few centuries here in the United States, which is why wolves were eliminated in the first place, because they killed cattle and they, you know, I don't know, they caused problems with people, and maybe they had beautiful fur. They do have some beautiful fur. But so in Washington, let me read this real quick. The Fish and Wildlife Commission could amend the proposal. Okay, so here's the deal. You know, there's obviously a wolf-loving group who petitions the government to make laws, okay? And what has been going on so far is that the Fish and Wildlife Commission of Washington decides when a wolf is considered to be a nuisance, like so much of a nuisance that it is killing cattle, and specifically the rancher goes to the Fish and Wildlife Commission and says, look, this is how many wolves, this is how many kills we've had, and we have evidence of wolves killing these calves. And, I mean, there's some pictures, man. It's kind of brutal, because these wolves, they don't just kill one calf to eat one calf. They kind of come in and kill like 5-10 calves, and they eat one or two, and then they leave. So, you know, they kind of killed way more calves than they needed, you know, that day. And the cattle ranchers are suffering. So the cattle ranchers, you know, yeah, the wolves were here long before cattle ranchers. I get that. But cattle ranchers, I mean, have been building these giant herds for so long. And now the wolves have been reintroduced. And, you know, we're all kumbaya. The wolves are back. And we're seeing a decline in deer population, decline in elk population, decline in cattle population. And so the Fish and Wildlife Commission in Washington have been the ones who would have this final say over whether or not a wolf has, or wolf pack has, caused enough damage to make the list to be euthanized, which means killed, shot dead on the spot. And of course, because this is such a controversial issue in Washington, they have the Fish and Wildlife Commission go out and kill the wolf, or wolves. Well, this wolf-loving group is trying to get the Fish and Wildlife Commission to actually spell out what rules they use to determine if a wolf has made the list or not. And then this wolf group wants to kind of review those rules and be notified when the Fish and Game Commission, Fish and Wildlife Commission, is going to go out and euthanize a wolf. So, you know, there's this big controversy, and, you know, they're trying to figure it out in Washington and whatever. And I'm just telling you, I think wolves are beautiful. They're a beautiful animal. Like any other North American animal, my belief is the wolf would be best managed by hunters, number one, not hunting them to extinction, but hunting them. Number one, you're going to generate some income for the state. Number two, you're not going to have Fish and Wildlife Commission go out and euthanize wolves, shoot wolves, and then do absolutely nothing with them. You know, put them in an incinerator, I guess. At least hunters would harvest that wolf, use that carcass, take that fur, you know, and actually pay to do that. And they've been doing that in states all across the country as this population has grown. So it works. It's been proven to work. Those wolf populations have been managed well, and they're very healthy and going strong. And year after year, guys apply for licenses to go kill wolves, and the population stays nice and healthy. And it helps manage, you know, the wolves for the cattle ranchers in those states, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I've said before, I don't know how many of you have been out in some of these areas where cattle are free ranging on BLM land and stuff, where there's a lot of encounters between wolves and livestock. But I can tell you this, not from any personal experience, maybe just personal knowledge of things similar to this that could happen. So let's say you have, 80,000 acres of land to put your cattle on, to graze your cattle on. And you're out checking up on them one day. You're either on horseback or you're on an ATV or whatever. And of course, you travel with sidearms, you know, firearms, because life is dangerous out there at times. Always good to have protection. And you see a wolf or wolves attacking. It would be wolves because they are a pack animal. You see wolves attacking your, you know, your calves. And they're just having a field day. You're going to fire a shot in the air, you think, to scare the wolves off? I mean, I'm not saying that ranchers are bad people. I'm just telling you the truth. They're going to protect their investment. They are probably going to kill the wolf, and nobody's going to know the difference. You know, if it's a collared wolf, they will make sure that that collar disappears and eliminate any evidence of that kind of kill going on. Because that's the way you do it out in the world. That's the way you do it out in the wild, out on these properties, these giant properties. You know, so I know this environmental group and the wolf-loving group. I respect them. I think it's awesome, you know, for them to be involved in making sure that wolves are protected. But I think you just have to use some common sense in all of these kind of areas. The cattle aren't going to go away, even though Bill Gates is trying to make sure we don't eat meat. They're going to be here for years and decades and maybe forever. And now the wolves are going to be around for years, decades, and maybe ever. Who knows? But we got to figure out the best way, you know, to manage these situations. And I think there's reasonable kind of agreements that could be made, you know. Farmers, ranchers are going to kill wolves if they're taking, you know, calves. And that's just the way it is. So, and the wolves are obviously doing great because there's so damn many of them. And you know, it's pretty cool when you see them too. I saw one in northern Idaho 20 years ago, seemed like a few years. Actually, it was a few years before they released the Yellowstone wolves. And, I actually saw on the peak of a hillside, and there was actually a guy standing right, a park ranger standing right next to me. We were kind of in a pull-off area. It wasn't a rest stop. It was just a little pull-off, and I go, holy hell. I go, is that a wolf right there? And he looks at me, and he looks at it. He goes, nope, that's just a dog. Hell, I was a biologist. My degree was in biology. I could obviously tell it was a wolf, and he was obviously observing it for one reason or another. It was a wolf. Beautiful out in the wild. Really beautiful animals. Powerful, too. Oh my gosh, they're so powerful. Anyway,
Well, thank you for listening to the Redneck
Hey,
Dennis
catch
podcast.
Me every Wednesday and Please Saturday at 9 p.m. Eastern on Real Liberty Media. Thanks for joining.
This podcast is not on the biggest platforms, but it is on the best free speech platform. Until next time, remember, all bleeding eventually stops.